Tracy Olson Wessner. I'm the director of the Museum of the American Military Family in Tejeros, New Mexico, and this is our podcast, At Ease. I'm speaking with playwright, comedian, filmmaker Elizabeth Liang. Hey there.
Hi.
So I became aware of you through your show, Alien Citizen, An Earth Odyssey, and I was intrigued enough to buy a copy of the DVD for our museum. And I'm glad you have a chance to talk to me today. I planned to show it last month at the museum, but we've been closed for the coronavirus pandemic. So I'm glad you took time to do this interview over the phone. And I wanted to say I really enjoyed Alien Citizen.
Thank you. I'm so glad. I'm so grateful to you for buying it for the museum, and I'm so glad that you enjoyed it.
Well, eventually we'll get around to showing it soon, hopefully. So I wanted to explain to our listeners, you're a self-proclaimed third culture kid. Can you explain to our listeners what that is, how you define that?
Yes, the definition has evolved over the years. So the one that works for me is the one that was going around about 6 or 7 years ago, which was that a third culture kid is someone who grew up outside their parents' culture, or cultures if the parents are from different cultures from one another.
Mm-hmm.
And that's usually then outside of their own passport country.
Mm-hmm.
And who incorporates elements of all the cultures that they grew up in as part of their, you know, memory and identity, but they don't have a feeling of belonging in any single culture. And they get the feeling of belonging from other people with whom they either have a similar upbringing or similar interests. But it's not about the country their parent or parents are from, and it's not about the country they were born in. It's not even necessarily about the countries they grew up in. It's just about having always been an outsider.
Ah, so one thing I didn't say is that you're a corporate. Your dad was stationed in many, many places overseas because he worked for a corporation. Do you want to give us like a couple of, you know, tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, he worked for Xerox.
Mm.
Back when Xerox was huge, some people listening to this will remember when Xerox was as big as Google or Apple, and nobody said, go photocopy this for me. People would say, go Xerox this, because that's how huge the company was. And it was known for making photocopying machines, as well as a gajillion other things. They invented everything, including like the mouse and the personal computer and all sorts of stuff. And they moved us. My dad got a job for them before I was born in Guatemala, which is where he was born and raised, and where my brother and I were born. My mom's American, and she thought she was going to spend the rest of her life in Guatemala.
Mm.
But Xerox moved us to Costa Rica, and then to the USA, and then to Panama, and then back to the USA, and then to Morocco, and then to Egypt, where I spent my high school years. And I came back to the U.S. for college on the East Coast, and then ultimately, as an adult, settled on the West Coast.
Wow.
But Xerox is what Xerox gave us our upbringing and our ability to see the world, and I'm very grateful for that.
So like many military brats, you must wrestle with the question, you know, where are you from? And the other question is, how many times did you move? So how do you answer that dreaded where are you from question?
Now I just say a lot of places. My dad worked for Xerox, and they moved us around. So I grew up in 6 countries. And then if people want to know more than that, they can ask. But it used to be an absolutely dreaded question. You're absolutely right. And now I've really processed all of that, and actually creating Alien Citizen, the show that then became a film, was very helpful with that process. So now it's no longer a charged question for me. I no longer worry about the person's reaction. That's their problem.
Okay, yeah. Yeah. So you mentioned you moved a lot and you lived, you know, in many places. Did you go to British or the U.S. schools overseas, or the international schools, or did you go to the local ones? And then
it depended. Sorry, go ahead.
No, so, and the other thing was, you know, so your, was your schooling, would you consider it uneven? Your, you know, just kind of uneven, like you, you didn't ever quite get the subject you were supposed to get at the right time.
Oh, got it. No, I, we were, my parents were concerned about us, about that, about us bouncing too much between too many different curricula.
Mm-hmm.
So abroad, we mostly went to American International School,
mm-hmm.
and that did give us a sense of continuity. Although each school was very different, the mm-hmm. teachers were very different. The American school in Casablanca, Morocco, had a lot of British teachers
mm-hmm.
who were teaching American curricula, but with a little bit of rebellion on their side.
Wow.
So that was kind of fun. But then I did go to a Spanish school, and by that I mean from Spain, mm-hmm. in Morocco as well, in the eighth grade. And that was the biggest of all culture shocks in mm-hmm. terms of schooling, because I hadn't been learning anything in Spanish since nursery school. I mean, we spoke it, but it was, my Spanish was getting worse and worse.
Mm-hmm.
So having to learn in what was my native language, but I was no longer fully fluent in a different vernacular,
mm-hmm.
because Spanish from Spain is highly different from Spanish from Panama and from Guatemala and from Costa Rica, which are different from one another as well, but they have more in common. You can Central Americans understand one another.
Right.
And it's not that I couldn't understand Spanish. It's just that they have different idioms. So I had to learn the new slang and, the, you know, mm-hmm. all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the one part of my education that felt imbalanced. It was a good education. It was just that I was always catching up. I was doing double the work because of the language. So I learned, that's when I learned empathy for all the students I'd known my entire life at the American International Schools for whom English was not their first language.
Right.
I finally truly understood what it was like for them and how you can be made to feel dumb
mm-hmm.
when you are not dumb.
Mm-hmm.
It has nothing to do with intelligence whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
There's just a bit of a language barrier that you have to overcome. So that was, it was good for me in terms of teaching me to be more empathetic, because I like to think I was an empathetic, sympathetic person, but I realized I wasn't. And I'm going to close the door now to my husband's office.
Okay. Yeah, this working from home is quite different for us now with this pandemic.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So, but other than that, it was mostly, and then in the States, it was American public schools.
So,
but again, they were still, you know, teachers and administrations can be very different, one school from another.
Right. Well, as a military wife, we moved 18 times in 20 years, and I was a school teacher, and I was always the new teacher for at least 15 of those 18 years. And it's hard because you have to develop new, you know, teaching skills, new curriculum and all that. So
yeah.
I can empathize. So two things. So where did you finally graduate high school from?
Cairo American College, also known as CAC, in a suburb of Cairo, Egypt, in Digla, which is a suburb.
Okay.
And I was in Cairo for the whole 4 years.
Wow. So how many languages do you speak then?
No, I really just speak Spanish and English. I mean, I understand French, and I can speak a little bit of it. And if you immersed me in France for 3 months, I'd walk away speaking it much better. But I haven't practiced it. And I was able to speak Egyptian Arabic. By the end of the 4 years, I could have a genuine conversation with, like, a taxi driver about politics. But I absolutely could not do that now. And that's my great... That is a regret of my life, that I didn't hold on to Arabic and French, and that my Spanish still isn't perfect, because the good thing is I'm in Los Angeles, so I hear Spanish around me, and I can turn on a channel or two or three and then watch telenovelas and stuff like that.
Mm.
But it's still, I'm still not immersed in it, and that's what you need. You just have to, you know, push everything else away and read and write and listen and talk in the language.
Right.
If you want to be fluent.
Right. So
I say I'm bilingual because compared to people who studied it for 4 years in high school, I absolutely am.
Uh-huh.
But compared to people who dream in both languages, I absolutely am not.
Yeah. So before we talk about your show and the DVD and your workshops, tell us a little bit more about your background. You're in show business. Did you graduate from college with a theater degree?
Well, my mom was an actor both in community theaters and professional theaters in every country we lived in, mostly community theaters in, outside of Guatemala, but also a professional theater in Guatemala. So I was like a theater kid. Mm-hmm. I was aware of all of that, and so I acted in plays in school and community theater, and then in college I almost became a drama major, but I was just too chicken. Because I knew that it was an extraordinarily difficult life to pursue, because I interned at the top casting office in Manhattan between my first and second year in college, and met all these great playwrights and saw all these great auditions and saw the absolutely random nature of casting. And it wasn't that the casting directors didn't want to cast good people. They always wanted to cast good people, and they tried. Mm-hmm. But the person who ultimately got the job... Mm-hmm. Boy, was that an absolute toss-up, crapshoot lottery. So I didn't pursue it, and I was an English major instead, which is kind of, I think, probably pretty common for a lot of people who love theater. They become English majors or they become psychology majors. because of interest in text, interest in story, and interest in human behavior. And then I moved to L.A., and I was not going to pursue acting because I thought that was crazy, but then I was surrounded by actors. Mm-hmm. And every time, you know, every waiter is an actor, and I went to the theater and thought, I could do that, and then I slowly started pursuing it kind of, sort of, and then after a few years, I realized you can't kind of, sort of pursue acting. It's impossible, especially in this town.
Right.
You have to go for it or not do it.
Right.
So I went for it. And then it was just as difficult as I say, but I have had some successes. You know, I have managed to book small roles on television. I've booked larger roles on independent films. I've booked commercials, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, you've been twice nominated the 5 best leading actresses in L.A. theater, so you're doing something right.
Yes.
And you've received several stage awards. So you're doing something right.
Yeah, sorry, go ahead.
No, that's okay. So were your parents supportive once you started getting more and more into the acting, or did they see your college degree being squandered?
No, they were wonderful. I will probably never truly fully understand how lucky I am, because I've just always been lucky that way, and they've always been extraordinarily supportive. You know, they don't want me to be foolish, so it's like definitely have... You know, if the acting income, if there's not enough acting income, have a day job.
Right.
But they know they raised someone who wasn't going to just be like, give me a handout, take care of me. That's just not, I'm not going to do that.
Yeah.
So I always held down anywhere between 1 and 4 day jobs, either full time or part time, cobbled together income between that and the acting and then Alien Citizen touring, and then workshops, etc. But I've been very lucky. My parents are utterly supportive, and I am one of the very few actors I've ever met anywhere in the world for whom that is true. So, yeah.
Yeah. So now, tell us about your play, Alien Citizen. But it's not a play. It's a one-woman show. Tell us a little bit about it, why you chose to write it up, and, you know, why did you then make a DVD from it?
I chose to write it because I had not heard or seen our story told anywhere. I mean, I guess you could say The Great Santini a little bit, but that's more about father-son than, you know, and I just, like, we're not the only ones. We met at a TCK's when we went to, every time we moved. And I had the idea for a few years, and then my brother sent me this call for essays for an anthology that was going to be about international students, third culture kids, global nomads. And I thought, if I write an essay about what it was like to create a solo show, I will be forced to create a solo show.
Right, right.
So I wrote this essay, and every little excerpt of the play that's in the essay is actually the first thing that I ever wrote for the one-woman show.
Wow.
And most of that stuff in the essay did not end up in the final version of the show, but it's what began it. And then I took a playwriting class and realized this isn't going to help me, because it really was for the instructor didn't really understand what a solo show was, even though she's a playwright, she sees a lot of theater. She was great, though. She gave me very excellent, excellent tips, but still just didn't understand how I was going to do it, didn't know how one person could play all these different roles. So then I took a class, a six-month workshop, a master class on starting and finishing a draft of a one-person show, and that really helped me have what I needed to then work from, because it still wasn't fully ready, but then I could work from that with a director, and my director was my dramaturg, and then I had a show, and I opened it in L.A. in 2013, and I had no idea if anyone would be interested, if I would have to cancel performances, or if I would have to cancel the run. And fortunately, word of mouth was good, and audiences grew and grew, and it ended up being a good, successful run, and enough people kind of heard about it on social media in other countries that were saying, are you going to make a movie? Are you going to make a movie? Because we can't see it here in Singapore.
Right, right.
But I thought, okay, I guess I'll make a movie. But then, ironically, I did end up taking the show itself to Singapore, to Iceland, to Panama, to South Africa, and to Spain. So it did tour.
So that makes me ask you, what kind of venues, when you go on tour with Alien Citizen, what kind of venues are you performing at? And then what kind of responses do you get from the audience?
The first ones were international schools and the U.S. Embassy in Panama, and then it was a proper theater in Iceland, and then conferences, one in a classroom in Spain and another in a proper theater, because it was a playwriting conference. It was wonderful, women playwrights. International in South Africa, and then again international schools in Singapore. And I did retire the live show after 6 years. I felt very done with it, but it was wonderful to get to tour it. And the response overall, also I've toured it around the USA, mostly at colleges and universities, but also at a few conferences and festivals. And overall, the response has always been mercifully good and quite wonderful. The third culture kids find out about it somehow, and for them it's very resonant, because they too haven't seen our story told.
Right.
But also multiracial people like myself, because I go into that, but what it is to be, have quote-unquote different races, and also intercultural people who grew up speaking different languages. I was surprised by how many people resonated with the character I call Hamid. I've changed his name. To protect him.
Yeah.
But who doesn't speak any language with what would be considered a native accent. All the languages he speaks are slightly sort of internationally foreign accented. And I met people in audiences who said, that's me. That's me. My whole life I've been teased because I speak, you know, blankety blank with an American accent, but I speak English with the other accent.
Right.
And that's been wonderful, just discovering how many people, including people who grew up in one place, speaking one language, surrounded by people who are a lot like them, who still related to it, because we've all been kids, we've all been teenagers, we've all been the odd one out at some point. We've all been in love, you know, requitedly or unrequitedly. You know, I go into that, there's a lot of teenage angst in the show, and everybody's been there.
Exactly. Well, I thought it was really a good show, and I was telling you earlier that I grew up to DOD parents, and so I didn't move as a child, but all my friends were military kids, and they moved every 3 years, and so I would have friends come and go every 3 years, but then as a military wife, we moved a lot. I have some words that I say with a Texas accent, and other words I say with a Southern accent, and then others are from Massachusetts. So it's, people always ask me, just based on my accent, where am I from, and you know, I'm kind of with you. I'm sort of used to it by now, because I did grow up in Germany, but it resonated with me. And I think that this film would resonate with a lot of the military kids too, even though, you know, you're talking more about like a corporate, a corporate moving and stuff, but there was so much there that just struck a nerve with me. I was laughing. I'm not a big laughy person, but I laughed. So I was going to ask you, why do you think it's important for you to actually, I know you said the story hasn't been told much, but why is it important for you to talk about multiculturalism and identity? Why was this story so important? Because, you know, it seems like it would only resonate with a small subculture, but are you finding that it is resonating with a lot more people? But why is it important to tell this story at all?
Because it's part of the human spectrum. It's part of the great prismatic, you know, rainbow of human stories. Mm-hmm. Like, why is it important to tell any story?
Mm-hmm.
Because
mm-hmm.
we've experienced it. Like, mm-hmm. why would any story be more important than any other?
Mm-hmm.
It's not. The point is that that's how human beings connect. And I'm going to be cliche and say, there we all were.
Mm-hmm.
thousands of years ago,
mm-mm.
hundreds of thousands, you know, mm-mm. sitting around a fire,
mm-mm.
and someone told a story, someone
mm-mm.
acted it out. It's the way we learn how other people live and how we might be able to follow that example or not follow that example. And just, we're interested in one another, you know.
Yeah.
You know, anybody who's not a narcissist is interested in other people.
Right.
And there's so many people have multicultural and intercultural life experiences. Like, there's tons of children of immigrants. There's tons of immigrants themselves. There's tons mm-hmm. of borderlanders who are right there between Texas and Mexico or, you know, Wisconsin and Canada. And that's just in the USA.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Europe, good Lord, they've been interacting with one another for forever, and Asia and Africa, like, all over the world, you know, the small town with people who are all exactly alike is rarer and rarer, I think.
Yeah, that is
and
true.
And even they are interested in how other people, you know, like, a lot of people leave those small towns because they're interested in meeting other people. So, and that alone is a multicultural experience for them, because now they've moved to whatever country or city or larger town. And it's just part of the human, it's part of the human experience, and so it should be told. That's what I think.
So, the more I read about you, and I read your bio, and the more impressed I am, but in addition to theater and film and TV, you're also a blogger and a published writer, and so I wanted to ask you to tell us a little bit about your work with Displaced Nation and your own blogs, and do you consider yourself to be an activist?
I guess I do. The Displaced Nation is an online wonderful resource for expats, third culture kids, people who are immigrants, people who, you know, are living in different countries from the ones they grew up in, perhaps, or who have had that experience. And I was asked to do this column in which I interviewed adult third culture kids
mm-hmm.
who worked in creative fields.
Mm-hmm.
So they were either artists or artistic. And that was a real joy, getting to know other people's stories. And I did that for about 3 years, and it was around once a month I'd interview someone. So if you go to thedisplacednation.com and then /TCK talent, I did that for about 3 years. And then that was taken over by Dunia Berticelli, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And she also interviewed people. But it was nice to not only meet other adult TCKs or interview them, but to learn what their artistic processes were and what made them become writers or painters or photographers, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
And then my blog is called Suitcase Factory,
mm-hmm.
And it's at suitcasefactory.wordpress.com, and it's all about creating and touring a solo show. But so much of it is about the creative process that mm-hmm. anybody who has made anything, anybody who considers themselves creative or artistic or is an artist, I hope they'll take a look at it, because it's a lot about that, about just like how you put the thing together and when to take breaks and how to remove things that are no longer working in the piece, et cetera. And if you're someone who's touring a show of any kind, I hope it'll help, because I get into the real, truthful, honest, nitty-gritty of what it's like to tour and how not glamorous it is. And if I had read that before I had first started touring, it would have helped me, because I felt very sort of discombobulated in the beginning. And then I do consider myself an activist. Yeah, I think I'm sort of an artivist, an activist for
Artivist.
For sericulture kids and multiracial people, just in making sure our stories are told.
Mm.
But also, just in general, I am kind of a good little civ. You know, I call my representatives and I write letters and I show up for marches when there are marches, that kind of thing.
Well, that's really cool. So getting back to Displaced Nation for a minute, a lot of military brats and veterans and people like that, they'll meet somebody like them. So let's go back to the brat. So brat will meet another brat, and instantly there's a click, there's a bond, even though they didn't go to the same, even they weren't even in the same countries. Or like veterans,
right.
they weren't even in the same wars, but they have this instant connection. And so did you find that with the people that you were interviewing on Displaced Nation? Was there like an instant bond or...
Yes, there was, but it was interesting how each one was unique.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
so,
mm-hmm.
So they might draw a different conclusion from mine from having a similar experience. But I think because we're third culture kids, we accept that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
you know, and we also do just understand, like everyone could talk about what it was like to try to adapt and try to fit in.
Mm-hmm.
And when they realized that that was no longer worth it in a certain situation, when striking out alone, terrifying and isolating as it can be, is the next step, because this particular circle is not your circle.
Mm-hmm.
And you
mm-hmm.
don't have to try to fit in with them. And that's a huge, 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 huge step for TPKs, I think,
mm-hmm.
because our life has taught us to do the opposite.
Yeah, to fit in, to adapt quickly and fit in, yeah.
And what you were saying about military brats, yeah, one of the first people to actually see an early rough workshop performance of the show is a dear friend who's a military brat. And the fact that she loved it made me think, okay, this might work.
Mm.
Because she grew up on military bases, very different from me. But still, you know, you're moving. You're moving and losing friends and gaining friends. And people like you who stayed in the same place, but there was a revolving door of friends coming and going, and they all spoke very poignantly when I performed this at international schools.
Mm.
Their story, I want you guys to tell that story, because that story's not told, and it's so important. There's a point at which, for a lot of them, by high school, they gave up. They were not going to make any new friends with the new kids. There was just no point, because those new kids were going to leave.
Right.
And that's very moving to me.
Yeah.
So I hope that story will be told, too.
So, in between all of your acting and your writing and your other pursuits, you still find time to teach workshops and other things. So can you tell us a little bit about some of the other things you're doing, the workshops? And
yes, currently, especially during this pandemic, workshops are what I'm doing the most. They're kind of all I'm doing. I lead workshops that help people to tell their own intercultural stories, either in memoir or as a solo show or as a personal essay, or if they want to be a public speaker and do it for TED Talks, etc. And I do them via Skype online, and that's been true for 6 years. I've been leading these workshops for a little over 6 years, both in person in L.A. and via Skype with people all over the world. Almost every continent. And I'm also trying to do that with colleges and universities, because I've always done those in person, and I'm hoping to try to get more bookings of the workshop at colleges and universities via Zoom, since that's how everyone's instructing nowadays. But it gives me great joy just to hear other people's stories and help and to facilitate bringing out the gold, because every story has gold in it. You just have to kind of find it. And that's been wonderful.
So what traits did you develop as a third culture kid that have helped you most in life?
All the things we already know, like it does help to have more facility with language. It does help to understand just enough to be able to get by. But also it kind of helps in ways that I think we're very attuned to human behavior, and we'll see that person is having a different reaction from the other people, and to help draw them out or help see what's going on there. like I find that I'll know something's wrong with someone before other people do, because I just see it. And that can be a good, I'm sure it's great for psychologists and psychiatrists and therapists and social workers, but it's also good for playwrights and actors, because that's what we do, we interpret. And just like being game, like I love to travel, and you know, you want to go try that restaurant? Okay, I'll go try that restaurant. And wanting to see, and really loving foreign films, films that aren't in English, I adore them. Just take me out of the USA. I live here, and I'm glad I live here, but I mean, I have all sorts of feelings about it right now. But I love any story that's set in places I have been and places I have not been. And I think that's, you know, we're a little more open to different experiences and other people's lives and understanding automatically that humans are human. And that's a good thing.
So do you get the urge to just up and move? I know that as a military wife, my family moved 18 times in 20 years, and we'd been living in Albuquerque for about 5 years, and I was panicking. I needed to go anywhere, somewhere. And occasionally, so I did. I actually moved for a year, and then I came back. But, you know, every once in a while, I start thinking, where would I live? Do you have that feeling, or are you pretty much like, okay, I'm good?
Well, the first 10 years in L.A., absolutely. Like, the first 5-6 years, every 2 years for those first 6 years, I literally would feel like, well, it's time to move. It's just time. It's just time. I've got it. I got the lay of this land. I get L.A., and it's time to go. But I was pursuing an acting career or toying with the idea of it, and I knew if you move now, you're going to start all over again.
Right, right.
And then the last 4 years, like years 6 to 10, every single year, every single year, it was time to go. And it really, it's a measure of, you know, how hard an acting career is to pursue and my understanding of that. And by then I had met my boyfriend who became my husband. And he wasn't going anywhere. And I had always said my whole life, I will never move for a man. But I found myself staying for a man and a career, both. And then about 10 years ago, I realized I can't do this anymore. I cannot live in the city anymore. I can't live in, I just can't, I'm going to lose my mind.
Right.
And thank goodness I created Alien Citizen, because it got me out of the city, out of the state, and out of the country regularly.
Yeah.
And that really saved my butt. And now that it's a film, before the pandemic, I was going to be taking it around outside the city and state to screen it and then have filmmaker talk back and maybe lead workshop. And hopefully that will happen. Once this worst part is over and we're all able to travel safely again. Because that's what keeps me sane. It's true. I'm just like you. It's like, it doesn't matter how big and sprawling LA is. It doesn't matter how many very, very different neighborhoods. It doesn't matter that the world is here. If you want Burmese food, you can get it.
Right.
That's not the same as going to Burma.
Exactly.
So I absolutely need to get out. So I hope that I'll be able to tour with the film and with my workshops again.
Well,
meanwhile, I'm staying at home, because of course, but I am like you in that sense. Need to get out.
So we need to wrap it up, but please, I know we mentioned a bunch of different sites and names of things. How can people find out more about you, your work? Give us your handles for your different social media so that our listeners can, you know, see what we were talking about. I'll put some links up too, but I just want you to tell, you know, how can people find out more about you and your work and anything else
you
want to talk about? Yeah.
Yeah, the website for the solo show is aliencitizensoloshow.com.
Okay.
And the website for the workshops is interculturalstorytelling.com. And my handle on Instagram is Hapalis, Hapalis. And on Facebook, you can just find, if you just search Alien Citizen Solo Show, that'll come up. And Intercultural Storytelling it'll come up, although it'll come up saying, tell your intercultural story, but it'll come up.
Mm.
And then Twitter is Elizabeth, a.k.a. Lisa. There's not enough room for the H in Elizabeth, which is my real name. So it's Elizabeth, a.k.a. Lisa.
Okay, hey, so that sprung something into my mind. What does Hapless mean? Because that's the name of your production company, is it?
Yes, it is. I came up with it years ago, and I don't love it anymore, but it's just stuck with me. It's Hapa is a Hawaiian word that means half or partial.
Mm-hmm.
And it used to be an epithet that people would use against anyone who was half foreign, mm-hmm. which usually meant half white, mm-hmm. Hapa Haole.
Oh.
But then over time it evolved and it just became anyone who was part Hawaiian and then anyone who was part Asian and or Pacific Islander.
Mm.
And it even more broadly has been used to mean anyone who is biracial or multiracial. So Hapa and then Lisa, short for Lisa. So I came up with Hapa Lisa years and years and years ago when I formed a production company to produce the Chekhov play Three Sisters.
Okay, all right, because I had been wondering about that. So is there anything else you would like our listeners to know about you or anything you'd care to spend the next last couple of minutes before we wrap up?
Just that you can now stream the film on Gumroad. If you go to the AlienCitizenSoloShow.com mm-hmm. site, it will lead you to where you can stream it for $4.99.
Oh, cool. That's helpful.
Anywhere in the world where you have internet. So I hope people will take advantage of that.
Okay, well, great. Gumroad? I've never heard of it. G-U-M?
R-O-A-D, yeah.
Okay. Well, no, that's good because there's a lot of people at home right now that are looking for new and fun things to do, and so that might be an outlet for them. So
that would be great. That'd be great.
You can stream it on gumroad.com. All right. Well, once again, this has been Circe Olson-Westner. I'm the director of the Museum of the American Military Family in Tejeras, New Mexico, and this was our podcast At Ease, and I've been speaking to Elizabeth Liang, and it's been a pleasure and a lot of fun. So thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure for me, too.